You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is the 11th of May, 2026, almost 2 o'clock in the morning. And apparently, I'm a latecomer to this topic. It may surprise you to learn that I've been writing on artificial intelligence for over a decade now. Originally it was merely commission papers, but the relationship of artificial intelligence to the regime and the military in particular has caused an uproar, which I only hinted at before. But I have to tell you, once you start down that rabbit hole, it's very difficult to pull yourself out of. Which is not necessarily a terrible thing, so long as you're fit to do it, intellectually speaking. Specifically, we're going to talk about Alex Karp's The Technological Republic, a book he allegedly authored last year. That is to say, the political ideology of that faction of Silicon Valley. And obviously, we're going to be talking about Palantir. Yeah, of course, it's not merely for military-related applications. It could be used in many places. But I've actually read the book rather than just the summary. I've read the book so you don't have to. You're not missing much. But I've always taken a very deflationary approach to artificial intelligence. I have to admit the public relations push behind it. It was interrupted by COVID for a while, but has been impressive. Let me start off by I'm quoting myself here in a paper I wrote called "Artificial Intelligence and Bad Metaphors: How the Scientific Establishment Gets It Wrong Again." I wrote that initially in 2013. Here's what I said. The mind is an organic, automatically organized entity that is a part of a broader cosmic natural order. The computer is a machine determined by its own internal mechanism. It's isolated from the ecosystem around it and depends on humans to keep it operational. Men have consciousness of free will and deliberation. The mere absorption of quantitative data and the extrapolation of generalities is neither learning nor intelligence. The brain is of a different order than the machine, and infinitely more complex. Memory regions of the brain are not data storage areas, but are also sources for goals, imagination, and creativity, the very opposite of determined, quantitative, mechanized objects. If anything, the more the scientific establishment learns about the brain, the less plausible AI becomes. The machine is, by definition, unfree. Hence, there cannot be communicability between the human brain and the artifacts of modern scientific technocracy. I also surprise you that artificial intelligence has been around for a long time. It really started in the 1950s at MIT, the RLE laboratories. And my argument over the last, well, since then, has been that if you've already reduced human intelligence to nominal empirical operations, then yeah, you can make a machine intelligent. But back then, the claim was a machine could simulate human intelligence. The people involved were not computer people. Margaret Mead was one of them. Always financed by Josiah Macy and the rest of these huge foundations, Ford and John von Neumann and Norbert Wiener. But the functional technology didn't exist at the time. It was still in its esoteric phase. It's normalized, of course, today. Yet, we're told that it's at the core of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Primarily, it's glorified pattern recognition. It's meant to work with big data. I'm assuming you know what big data is. But the PR campaign has been extraordinary. The exaggerated capabilities you have, and if we get to it, there are papers that I know are commissioned by these corporations in the big think tanks. You have this convergence, tech, media outlets, venture capital, PR, this narrative that AI is not just a tool, but a revolutionary force. Now, it's in their interest to write things like this. They want to showcase their tools. They're boosting stock prices, etc. So much of their initial funding comes from governments. Although, if they're, you know, the U.S. is using these tools against Iran, it's not exactly impressive. I mean, even academics, they'll do, you know, their horse. They'll overstate these things. AI has been so fashionable. People, you know, essentially read into it whatever they want to. I mean, the regime told the world about autonomous vehicles, but these aren't practical. Remember, we were told about AI diagnoses in healthcare. That failed. If you remember, the same exact predictions were made about the internet 30 years ago, about the same revolutionary implications that it was going to have. So, but people like Alexander Dugin, who you know I'm a big supporter of, who has been strange recently, as some of you have noted. My friend Alexander contacted me breathlessly about some of the things he said about Rhodesia, which I cannot defend. I tend to want to give him a pass because of the murder of his daughter. And the body of his work, though, rather than the crazy tweets, is what you should look at. And I do not know the influence of alcohol on some of these things. Anyway, Palantir, I know I'm late to the party here, but at the same time, you know, no one's going to approach this like me. This is a company producing software dealing with big data, that is to say, large volumes of data for governments and whoever else. Now, its founder, Alex Karp, published what he calls a manifesto. We could summarize it in 22 points. That's all over the place. Summarizing the mentality here. Laying out the corporate AI movement, if you want to call it that. He talks about, you know, the new arms race of artificial intelligence. And while not saying so, he clearly refers to coming wars against Russia and China. These points are a summary of the longer book, The Technological Republic, Hard Power, Soft Belief, and the Future of the West. Crown Currency was the publisher in 2025. Very much like Peter Thiel, it's reads either like, you know... At least Peter Thiel would be a very good undergraduate paper. I think that this was written by AI. And he added terms like the future of the West to make it appear scholarly, but it is not. Both Peter Thiel and Karp are just, they write like a set of cliches strung together. I mean, if it's an AI company, for Karp to have this written by AI, that would be appropriate. Ultimately, it comes down to billionaires arguing that the innovations of their own company are the key to history. That seems to be a little bit too convenient. But who is Alex Karp? Many of you know what he looks like. He is racially mixed, which is no surprise. And he is a Jewish socialist. He's a leftist, both in ideology and activism. Peter Thiel is part of the so-called Dark Enlightenment. We'll get to that in a minute. I've kind of avoided that because I don't take it that seriously. But both of those men, they have very odd personal histories. But we know at some point they were tapped by elite organizations. They're both part of Bilderberg and every other elite forum in existence. But being a leftist, a socialist, and all that does not contradict this, being a part of these organizations. It should surprise no one that they are Zionists, especially Karp, and they back the Gaza slaughter. He is a sexual revolutionary. Thiel is a homosexual. Karp speaks of national service, or the draft, and yet he has no allegiance to any nation, I suppose other than Israel. That firm is so Jewish they had their first stockholder meeting in Tel Aviv. And yet, this is one of the companies used by the Pentagon in high-tech warfare. Now, I said that they have strange personal histories. Most people, when they want to know something, they go to Wikipedia. And it's unfortunate, but we have to live there. Here's what Wikipedia says about Karp. And see if you could piece this together. Karp began a career as a research associate at the Sigmund Freud Institute in Frankfurt. He received an inheritance of $12,000 from his paternal grandfather, with which he founded London-based money management firm Kedmon Group. After he gained some success with the stock market, some European high-net-worth individuals invested in his company. Karp later claimed that his goal at the time was to amass $250,000 to return to Berlin and read and write as a dilettante. For some time, he helped Thiel to gather funding for Clarium Capital. In 2004, along with Thiel and others, Karp co-founded company we're talking about here, Palantir Technologies, becoming its CEO. The New York Times, of course, ranked Karp as the highest paid CEO of a publicly traded company in 2020. The company went public with a compensation worth $1.1 billion, but that's not the main source of his wealth. Well, it seems like a few steps were deleted here. And certainly it's not just Wikipedia. At some point, $12,000 led to a company that had, quote, some success with the stock market. And that, in turn, led to some very wealthy people investing in him. As it stands, that doesn't make any sense, unless, of course, he was part of something much larger. He's initiated, he's used to create the institutions so many others are talking about. None of these men have any training in business. And certainly they know very little about computer programming. That's done, the serfs do that for him. But groups like the Atlantic Brücke, Bilderberg, the Business Council, the Economist Group, saw him as their version of Greta Thunberg, an excellent promoter for their agenda. But when you see a personal history like this, it's, you know, you have to think critically, which is not easy to do. But the book that is so influential, apparently, I mean, when a billionaires, regardless of how they got their money, whether they deserve it or not, when they write a manifesto, you need to take it seriously. He talks about AI-based weaponry, the limits of soft power or influence. He talks about the absolute necessity of conflict. And very conveniently, that the nuclear era is over. He also claims that, quote, American power has enabled an extraordinarily long period of peace. And even worse, talks about cultures that are advanced and some that are permanently dysfunctional and regressive. I have the feeling I know who he's talking about there. Peter Thiel, the other founder, his history is murky as well. Some of you may know he is Michael Hoffman. I've been reading Michael Hoffman on the subject. Traveled to Rome to give lectures on Antichrist. I don't know what qualifies him in this regard. But his lectures on Antichrist are certainly constrained by his financial self-interest. Margarita Furlan, a journalist from Rome, said the following. Palantir's Mosaic platform is integrated into the IAEA verification system. That's the International Atomic Energy Agency. When between the 6th and the 12th of June 2025, Mosaic flagged an alleged increase in enriched uranium at Iranian facilities, assessing that Iran was potentially just weeks away from producing multiple nuclear warheads. That assessment formed the basis of Israeli intelligence against Iran. The IAEA Board of Governors approved a non-compliance resolution on June 12th. Israel struck the following day. Trump then authorized the attacks on Iranian facilities. The early days of that war, Palantir's price rose by 15% in a week, while in fact the NASDAQ overall fell by just over 1%. Peter Thiel is a very well-connected, we call a political theologian. He is a dilettante. These are both lawyers. It's shocking. I read, in Peter Thiel, I've read The Straussian Moment by him, and I haven't read much else. Hoffman informs us that both were financed by Epstein, at least for a time. But he is the co-founder of a company that provided the intelligence to justify the war in Iran. And he has a very close connection with the vice president. He profits directly from the war. He promotes himself as a Roman Catholic trying to mobilize, evangelicals, Christian Zionists of all types within the military-industrial complex to legitimize what's happening. But his intellectual pursuits, as paltry as they are, serve only his financial interests. And of course, that of the Israelis. His wealth, his Zionism, and his Russophobia are his shields against being removed to the sidelines. Oh, and he's homosexual, quote unquote, married to one of the vice presidents of BlackRock. Yet, he is called the voice of national conservatism in more than one source. And funny, those who have written on his secret lectures in Rome, he claims that he talks about the keton, the restrainer, which caught my attention. And he defines it this way. It's St. Constantine the Great, the Tridentine liturgy, the political order, and stabilized wealth. That was his definition. That's completely idiosyncratic. The church fathers placed this in the hands of the Roman emperor, not in stabilized wealth. And the liturgy of Trent did not exist in Constantine's time. I would give the Straussian Moment, if it was like a junior level undergraduate paper, I would give it an A. He uses a lot of unnecessary Latin phrases, well-known ideological slogans, and provides a very superficial knowledge of the authors that he talks about. But of course, that's not his real function. He's a lawyer and a financier. I suppose to the uninitiated, he sounds like a right-wing intellectual, but he is publicly a part of the regime, as is Karp. They're both leftists who use right-wing slogans to somehow disguise it. Well, we could fill in some of these gaps with the CIA Venture Capital Fund, InQtel. Palantir established itself, among others, as an important provider of security, intelligence, and data analysis for various government agencies outside of the Pentagon, too. $4.5 billion in 2025, according to their, is their main revenue in, according to their yearly report. Now, Alexander Dugin has taken this and ran with it. And we'll talk about that in a little bit, but this company is embedded within the Trump administration and the Pentagon. The company, in its yearly statement, lays out its main products. And the language that they use to describe what they do was irritating to me. But I looked at the one for 2023, Gotham Foundry and AIP. These are you know, platforms and methods. The Gotham platform is described this way. Gotham enables users to identify patterns hidden deep within datasets, ranging from signals intelligence sources to reports from confidential informants. It also facilitates the handoff between analysts and operational users, helping operators plan and execute real-world responses to threats that have been identified within the platform. Gotham is now used broadly across government functions. We also offer Gotham to our commercial customers. They also can use something called large language models, LLM, a neural network trained on a vast amount of text for language generation. It can summarize, even translate texts in many contexts. It's like the chatbot idea. But that's only as good as its programmer. The language is not so much dense as it is deceptive. It was probably either early this year or late last year. I talked about the various platforms the Israelis were using to hunt down and murder Hamas leaders. I don't think I mentioned Palantir, but I may have. Anyway. The 22-point summary of the book, The Technological Republic, it doesn't seem like it's saying very much unless you understand the symbols that it's using. Let me go through it. Silicon Valley, he says, owes a moral debt to the country that made its rise possible. Engineering elite of Silicon Valley has an affirmative obligation to participate in the defense of the nation. He doesn't make that very clear what he's talking about. He's talking about Israel, the U.S., or the empire as a whole. Number two is a strange one. We must rebel against the tyranny of the apps. Is the iPhone our greatest creative, if not crowning achievement as a civilization? It's changed our lives, but it may also be limiting and constraining our sense of the possible. Number three, free email is not enough. The decadence of a culture or civilization, and indeed its ruling class, will be forgiven only if that culture is capable of delivering economic growth and security for the public. The decadence of a culture, in other words, the regime can drive the culture to Epstein-level lows. But that's okay if they can deliver economic growth and security. Of course, it's done neither of those things. Number four, the limits of soft power, which he defines as soaring rhetoric, which it is not, have been exposed. The ability of free and democratic societies to prevail requires something more than moral appeal. It requires hard power. And hard power in this century will be built on software. Well, it was built on software in the last century, too. Five, the question is not whether AI weapons will be built, it's who will build them and for what purpose. Our adversaries will not pause to indulge in theoretical debates about the merits of developing technology with critical military and national security applications. They will simply proceed. Number six, national service should be a universal duty. We should, as a society, seriously consider moving away from an all-volunteer force and only fight the next war if everyone shares in the risk and the cost. I mean, this is absolutely transparent. This is something that William F. Buckley wrote in his little book called Gratitude, as I read on the plane in 1990, I think. When I was just getting started in these things. The manpower shortages in the U.S. are just beyond repair. And of course, he's demanding the draft. Well, even that's not going to help because most Americans of draft age are not in a position to physically and mentally be in the military. Anyway, seven, if a Marine asks for a better rifle, we should build it. And the same goes for software. We should, as a country, be capable of continuing a debate about the appropriateness of military action abroad or remaining unflinching in our commitment to those we have asked to step into harm's way. I don't know what debate among whom. Eight, public servants need not be priests. Any business that compensated its employees in the way that the federal government compensates public servants would struggle to survive. In other words, they need to be paid more. Number nine, we need to show far more grace towards those who have subjected themselves to public life. The eradication of any space for forgiveness, jettisoning of any tolerance for the complexities and contradictions of the human psyche, may leave us with a cast of characters at the helm we will grow to regret. 10. The psychologization of modern politics is leading us astray. Those who look to the political arena to nourish their souls and sense of self, who rely too heavily on their internal life finding expression in people they may never meet, will be left disappointed. Well, number nine is certainly true as far as it goes. But they have a specific agenda because, of course, they were Peter Thiel, I think, is mentioned in the Epstein files more than any other name. So some of these people are very concerned with, you know, staying out of the public light in that regard. 11. Our society has grown too eager to hasten and is often gleeful at the demise of its enemies. The vanquishing of an opponent is a moment to pause, not rejoice. Well, I don't know who he's talking about there. There's been no defeat since 1945. The U.S. is the only one that's been defeated. 12. The atomic age is ending. One age of deterrence, the atomic age is ending, and a new era of deterrence built on AI is set to begin, which, of course, someone who profits from AI is likely to say. I'm not sure why the two couldn't coexist. Number 13. No other country in the world has advanced progressive values more than this one. The U.S. is far from perfect, but it is easy to forget how much more opportunity exists in this country for those who are not hereditary elites than in any other nation on the planet. 14. American power has made possible an extraordinarily long peace. Too many have forgotten or perhaps take for granted that nearly a century of some version of peace has prevailed in the world without a great power military conflict. At least three generations, billions of people, and their children and grandchildren, have never known a world war. Now, as I read that, you should note these things. The post-war neutering of Germany and Japan must be undone. the defanging of Germany was an overcorrection for which Europe is now paying a heavy price. Similar and highly theatrical commitment to Japanese pacifism will, if maintained, also threaten to shift the balance of power in Asia. That's in Chapter 3 of the book. 16. We should applaud those who attempt to build where the market has failed. The culture, which is very vague, almost snickers at Musk's interest in the grand narrative, as if billionaires ought to simply stay in their lane of enriching themselves. Any curiosity or genuine interest in the value of what he has created is essentially dismissed, perhaps lurks from beneath a thinly veiled scorn, i.e. they need to be culture creators or culture destroyers. 17. He shifts gears. Silicon Valley must play a role in addressing violent crime. Many politicians across the U.S. have shrugged it off when it comes to violent crime, abandoning any serious efforts to address the problem, or take on any risk with their constituencies or donors in coming up with solutions and experiments, which should be a desperate bid to save lives. Well, we've dealt with this many times. The regime thrives on violent crime. Violent crime is also racial-based, so it cannot be destroyed. It is mostly a non-white affair. In the inner cities, it's almost exclusively a non-white affair, which is why there is no attempt to do anything about it. Now he's back to public life again. 18. The ruthless exposure of the private lives of public figures drives far too much talent away from government service. Can you get any more transparent than this? The public arena and the shadow and petty assaults against those who dare to do something other than enrich themselves has become so unforgiving that the Republic is left with significant a roster of ineffectual, empty vessels whose ambition one would forgive if there were any genuine belief structure lurking within. What he's saying is that because the oligarchs have such sordid pasts, they can't get too public right away. We can't be looking at their pasts. We need to just read their manifestos. 19. The caution in public life that we, I don't know who we is, unwittingly encourage is corrosive. Those who say nothing wrong often say nothing much at all. 20. The pervasive intolerance of religious belief in certain circles must be resisted. The elite's intolerance of religious belief is perhaps one of the most telling signs that its political project constitutes a less open intellectual movement than many within it would claim. Well, that comes from chapter 17 of the book. It's not religious belief as such. It's faith in general, and is very vague. 21. Some cultures have produced vital advances. Others remain dysfunctional and regressive. All cultures are now considered equal. Criticism and value judgments are forbidden, yet this new dogma glosses over the fact that certain cultures are indeed subcultures. Some of them have produced wonders. Others have produced middling and worse, regressive and harmful. Have proven middling and worse, regressive and harmful. He doesn't say who, which is, of course, telling. We know exactly who he's talking about. We must resist the shallow temptation, finally, of the vacant and hollow pluralism. We in America, and more broadly the West, have for the past half century resisted defining national cultures in the name of inclusivity, but inclusivity into what? Some of this, of course, is simple self-interest, financial self-interest. A lot of it has to do with, you know, getting people off their backs over Epstein. I want to quote Michael Hoffman in this regard. Epstein spent years putting Thiel in touch with his former Israeli prime minister and former defense minister, Ehud Barak, arranging at least six separate meetings. Dinner in 2014 at Epstein's Manhattan flat brought all three together to discuss Israeli security. According to Epstein's emails, the conversation touched on assassination squad and ice cream. The relationship yielded concrete business deals. Epstein directed Thiel towards two Israeli cybersecurity startups with roots in Unit 8200. the Israeli military cyber intelligence arm. Barak also urged Epstein to organize a seminar on AI and warfare with Thiel and others. Documents further show that Valar Ventures, Thiel's fund, accepted $40 million from Epstein and that Thiel exchanged extensive correspondence with him for 5 years prior to his death. That comes from Hoffman's paper, Peter Thiel's Antichrist, April 21st, 2026. This is why they're so concerned with public servants being looked at too closely. This is a new breed of oligarch. Fanatically Zionist. And this, by the way, what I just read to you, these 22 points, come from someone claiming to be, you know, comes from a racially mixed Jew, claiming to be a socialist, left libertarian or something like that. Proving the point that, of course, the left is the war party in this country. So, I came across this topic again, which I'm sorry, it's been around, I know, for a year or so, and I either missed it or I just didn't want to do it. I came across it with Alexander Dugin's work. And he describes his opinion on the matter. Let's remind our listeners what Palantir is. It's one of the key startups created by Peter Thiel and Alex Karp in Silicon Valley. They're developing a system for global surveillance of everything happening on the planet, in space, civil society of Western countries, far beyond their borders. All these databases converge into unified hubs, into centers which, despite their formal private status, are deeply integrated into the system of intelligence agencies and political decision-making. So he talks about the Orwellian world. Now, we've been talking about this for decades now. Every new technology seems to be, of course, abused by these people. And all the same predictions are made. Dugin says that all sensors, satellites, phones, any device capable of transmitting anything are connected to a single network. The line between online and offline is becoming blurry. In fact, it's seamless. But this is what big data is really all about. Huge arrays of data have to then, patterns have to be found within it. Decoding, cataloging, accumulating all of this in one place in real time. But that's what AI essentially is. Dugin claims that Palantir is not just a multi-billion dollar company. It's the embodiment of the West itself and its technological superiority. I'm not sure that, in fact, the West is technically superior. As soon as we, and by saying we, he's referring to Russians, come into contact with anything digital, and we do this constantly, we instantly fall within its sphere of influence. Everything we say, write, and do, even a turned-off gadget, instantly becomes their property, the surveillance system. He says. And he puts this in the context of the war in Ukraine. It's a new type of war. And it's true. This is the first time where drones have been one of the dominant elements. And it's been difficult for a lot of people, including myself, to make that adjustment because some of them, not all of them, but some of them are fairly inexpensive. Drones, tracking systems, satellites, secure communication channels, high-precision guidance, all of this. But whoever has that has the advantage. Well, if he's arguing that the U.S. has that, then clearly they don't have the advantage. What Dugin says, though, is somewhat doubtful. He says tanks, ships, infantry, and even individual soldiers are losing their former significance right before our eyes. Now, it's only a partial truth. I mean, they both work together. And clearly, the Ukraine war is mostly war of propaganda on the one hand and artillery on the other. He says Russia is marching towards victory, and he's referring to the war. But this war would have ended long ago were it not for these new parameters, these forms of civilization and warfare entirely unknown to us. Well, that's not true, both specifically and generally. Russians were quite adept at drone warfare. The Chinese are slightly ahead of the U.S. in some of these things. He says, behind the disputes within American politics, behind Trump's election and his strange behavior when he posts 20 contradictory messages a day, the contours of real power we are dealing with are gradually emerging. This is Palantir, the Technological Republic, named after Alex Karp's book. Previously, many thought it was just an ambitious startup promoting its product, something to attract customers, but it is something much greater. That this is not merely a project or a PR thing, but the key to deciphering reality and how the West is functional. I interpret it as propaganda by a very desperate regime struggling to maintain their control over either the battlefield or wherever they could be found. I mean, they've been badly beaten in Iran. Then Dugin says something very strange. He talks about the 22 points I just read. It directly states, he says, that the humanistic values of the past are no longer needed. Well, of course, it's just a revelation of the method. Dugin was the one who opened up our eyes as to what liberalism really was. It is an authoritarian system. The proposal is that liberal humanism is consigned to history in favor of the ruthless advancement of the regime's interests through violence, power manipulation. Well, that is not contradictory to what liberalism is. We quote Dugin again here. He says, the recipe for saving the unipolar world, which has begun to crack, is total global surveillance and the concentration of big data in the hands of the U.S. It is no coincidence that Peter Thiel and Alex Karp, regulars of the Bilderberg Club and the World Economic Forum, are now dictating this agenda. The fact that Thiel's name appears on the Epstein list almost more frequently than any other, along with the names of people from Trump's inner circle, only underscores the nature of this elite. This manifesto itself contains a call to ignore the psychological or moral peculiarities of the representatives of this new ruling class. Well, this is something that Dugin has been predicting for a long time. I'm not sure why he's surprised here. He uses the phrase techno-fascism. Now, this concept of fascism, it's defined very differently in Russia. But fascism is a term that has a very specific definition that Dugin should know. The sole criterion for success in this world, according to Dugin, is technological development, meaning that nuclear weapons take a back seat. That is a non sequitur. Artificial intelligence in and of itself is not a weapon. It's a tool that is used. He goes even farther. He says, it amounts to dismantling the system at Yalta and overturning the outcomes of World War II. Traditional international law no longer means anything. Of course, it never did. Might makes right, and power lies with those who control information and methods of total surveillance. We've woken up to this world in April of 2026. Against the backdrop of the rollout of Neuralink chips and the talk of technological singularity, we find ourselves in a post-liberal dictatorship. Now, the rule of technocratic elites is openly proclaimed, and they do not even attempt to hide their true goals. Again, this is something that Dugin himself predicted. This should not be a surprise to him. Well, of course, the nuclear shield requires colossal infrastructure, production, maintenance, management, signal transmission. It's an entire community, an entire world. But that's what lies within the Palantir system. So he now backtracks, because this is just a matter of big data. This is just a matter of Palantir being simply a method, a mechanism of integration. It's not that other methods of warfare have no value. It's not going to be on a different foundation. Well, so far, the foundation has been very unimpressive. Remember, this is only one company. They have many competitors. DataWalk, AWS, Databricks, Informatica, you know, things like Snowflake, SAS, and Alteryx. You know, it's certainly not all powerful, but it is integrated within the regime. And of course, he says something that's very profound here. Either we create our own, by we he means Russians, and those sympathetic to them. Either we create our own absolutely sovereign technological system inaccessible to the West, or we knowingly become its digital colony. Well, that's what the manifesto states, if the symbols are read properly. Of course, it's going to retain the ability to use whatever weapons it has. But we see how it works in practice. And he says, how did the Iranian president die? President Raisi. How was the leadership of Hezbollah in Lebanon destroyed? They had pagers and phones, if you remember that disaster. Even when they used the most outdated communication models, that proved sufficient to identify, locate, and eliminate them. He's in a fit almost of depression here, a fit of pessimism. He says, how was the entire political, religious, and military leadership of Iran destroyed just recently? Well, that's not true. But yes, the Israelis, like always, murdered many officials. That's true, but they've been doing that for some time. Palantir did it. In other words, they provided the data for it. They killed them, not just Mossad, CIA, Pentagon. The U.S. and Israel did not have such detailed information about every meeting, movement, and the condition of Iran's leaders that would still be at the helm of state. And the same applies to the leadership of Hamas and Hezbollah. Well, the Israelis have been doing this for a very long time, long before AI's been around. Anthropic, one of the alleged competitors to Palantir, their Claude method was used to target the primary school in Iran, killing 180 people, mostly young girls. Afterwards, President Trump did praise Palantir Technologies. That's great power, great warfighting capabilities and equipment. Just ask our enemies, he said. Well, I guess, including young girls. Now, we didn't need this manifesto to tell us that Russia and China is the next target. It's the current target. He backtracks again. AI is not a new world. It's just a faster means of digging through information. Russia is and should be defending its independence. When I heard about the possibility of sanctions against Russia being lifted, my first thought personally was that does this mean that there's going to be a temptation to plug into Western sources of funding again? Is this going to be a bad thing? Russia has thrived with sanctions. He said, we are losing the battle for digitalization and sovereign artificial intelligence by a landslide. That's simply not true. something that's been on the SEO agenda for a long time. But he says, you know, but to build sovereign artificial intelligence, we have to first possess natural intelligence. A genuine independent mind capable of perceiving Russia as a unique civilization with its own traditional values. So he has, in his reaction to this, he's a little incoherent. He goes back and forth. If the U.S. warfighting capabilities recently are an expression of Palantir's methods, then I don't think Russia has anything to worry about. Now, they pretend to be philosophers. They are not. Ideas still rule, and we're reminded of that all the time. I think people in the scientific establishment or Palantir, the very last people who should be defining what intelligence is. It's not necessarily about Russophobia or anything like that. Russia's just collateral damage in his mind. As the U.S. struggles to maintain unipolar dominance, by these methods. Well, this is nothing new. It's just a faster computer. This is simply what computers do. I disagree with Dugin that volitional decision-making and consciousness are remotely conceivable or possible for computers. He says as soon as the level of volitional decision-making, the situation is founded, the situation will change fundamentally. And he claims that LLMs, large language models, are leading us to this. So he goes back and forth. He then again, Palantir's preparing the infrastructure. In essence, a kind of ruler of the world, a man-made Leviathan, no longer controlled by humans. I think that, you know, he's taking the PR way too seriously. How convenient would it be for an oligarchy to be able to blame everything on artificial general intelligence when things go wrong? Elon Musk says that singularity, the total integration, has already arrived. Mark Anderson, the head of Anthropic, says the same thing. Well, certainly in their interest to say all of this. He says, Dugin says, the release of this 22-point manifesto is a crucial milestone, and we cannot treat it with skepticism. This document brings together a multitude of disparate factors. Most likely the publication of the manifesto was not the beginning of a process to seize global power, but a confirmation that the West, as a global power, is already as close as possible to achieving total control. Otherwise, such candor would be premature and dangerous. It could unnecessarily frighten and mobilize opponents, since we are no longer talking about the usual liberalism, but about something much harsher. Well, we've been talking about harsher things for a very long time. It's a private man, well-connected Jew, wants to promote his liberalism, homosexuality, whatever, by the same methods, and that Palantir is going to be at the core of it and profiting from it. He even goes so far as to say that Carl Schwab's Great Reset is a smokescreen to divert attention. I have no idea where that comes from. He said that in an interview with Sputnik, I think. When this paper comes out, I'll have all the citations. AI was a huge part of that concept. Liberalism and the ideology of AI exist together, serve the same purposes, and one created the other. normally, Alexander Dugin is far more precise in his writing, not this back and forth. He's upset that liberalism has abandoned its humanitarian principles. But none of us ever thought that it was really about those principles, you know, immigration, whatever. That these new elites, these new Zionists, are ready to abandon humanitarian principles. Manifesto, he says, explicitly says the total control will reduce crime to zero and strictly limit immigration flows. It does not say that, and nothing I read to you said that. And of course, the draft, it does say that. Although the joke can be on them. More than 80% of Americans of draft age are not fit for military service. Dugin seems to think that it was these two, Thiel and Karp, that brought Trump to power. I'm not so sure, but they certainly helped. But they have tremendous influence within the Pentagon. He says that Trump is not a liberal. Even neoconservatives have disowned him. Palantir is an upgraded version of the neocons, something far more dangerous. It is a true kingdom of the Antichrist. I'm hoping he's just being figurative here. It is not that. It doesn't hurt it. He does go on the arrogance of Peter Thiel, you know, traveling the world talking about Antichrist. And publishing manifestos, the time is singularity is already here. There's no point in hiding it, which, of course, is the revelation of the method. They don't have to hide anymore. We've always known that Fukuyama idea where free trade and peace and everything else was going to be the result of all. No, this is something, this is global domination. Without any sugarcoating. But his own theory says this. The term accelerationism comes up once in a while. There's a lot of neologisms within these ideas. A lot of it's irritating. It's neo this and paleo that. And it's irritating enough where I don't get into it very much. But let me define accelerationism for you. It's been around since at least Marx. It's the deliberate promotion of what Marx called immiseration to prove to the world what alienation and poverty really is. In other words, for Karl Marx, it's better that the workers be treated worse than better for the sake of the coming revolution. Or it could simply be simpler than that. And just mean the hastening of humanity's destruction. I think that, some of that is certainly true. But Palantir, at the center of it, I mean, to the point where Karp is married, again, quote-unquote, married to the, Thiel is married, quote-unquote, to the one of the vice presidents of BlackRock. Well, that comes very close. Left-wing accelerationism, you know, is done through a liberal lens. He talks about right-wing accelerationism, the so-called Dark Enlightenment. Well, you know, and that's popular among Silicon Valley oligarchs. The end of history will not be peace and light. It will be brutal. Getting rid of people who become unnecessary in the new era. But we knew that with the Fourth Industrial Revolution. We knew that in 2019 with Bill Gates. The fear of being obsolete is a lot more than just dealing with technology. It's dealing with people. Again, I take a more deflationary view of the matter But I don't want to simply dismiss it either, because these are very powerful people. AI is just a faster computer. It's a quantitative improvement. I don't like the idea that social scientists are defining what intelligence is. And it's usually a disastrous concept. I'm going to quote myself again here. In 2013, I said, Leo Strauss argues that most of the modern concepts of intelligence, knowledge, and progress are irrational. Few of the normal definitions of intelligence make any reference to morality. That's a problem, at least because it gives us no guide as to what data we should be concerned with. Yet there is no essential value to serve as a moral purpose. Then what basis do we decide which facts are important? These all imply value, which in the sciences are viewed as subjective and beyond the competence of science as such, at least in theory. Therefore, Strauss concludes, since they cannot give us any reason to collect data or be logical, the sciences are irrational. People use reason because they have an end, a purpose. If they do not, or the end is very bad, just a base, then reason is either A, arbitrary, or B, a slave to passion, and hence irrational. The end itself has to have a moral component, which itself is in accordance with logos, the broader reason of the universe, and natural law. That's what I wrote in 2013, when these issues first came up. If you remember, in 2013, some of the most wild predictions were being made. I remember very distinctly the same predictions were made about the internet. 95, 96. Yeah, certainly it has been a quantitative improvement. I think it's given the right wing the ability to speak with people who would never, I mean, certainly I couldn't function if it wasn't for the internet. But that was going to take the place of governments. That was going to take the place of civil society. Well, that's a separate issue. This issue has been around for a very long time. I mentioned Dreyfus's What Computers Still Can't Do, A Critique of Artificial Reason. That book came out in 1972. And the arguments there still hold up today. The assumptions made about artificial intelligence have yet to be answered. AI assumes that the human brain operates according to hard and fast rules. It assumes that all knowledge it can be formalized, or should be formalized. They assume that humans possess knowledge in bits, just like computers do. And hence reality is what the nominalists and positivists say it is. The whole issue is whether or not one is justified in holding that the human brain operates like a computer. During the Industrial Revolution, the human brain was always, or the, you know, anything, human brain, human body, was treated as a machine. Now, the body and brain are treated like computers, whatever the dominant technology is. Some of you may remember Watson, the computer that won the game show against human competitors, Jeopardy, I think it was. This was pure PR. It was arranged for maximum public impact. It could only be a fact-based game show format. Watson could only regurgitate facts. It cannot grasp humanities or meanings, context, history, ethical, other creations of human freedom. It can just read and repeat faster. All the questions were, of course, your basic fact-related questions. So it's unimpressive, except for the sheer amount of material it can regurgitate. It doesn't understand anything. It doesn't know that it's on Jeopardy. And this is not occurring in the future. We would have to accept nominalism as true if that were to be the case. It was MIT's Sajit Rao who designed Watson's language recognition system at MIT. He said the same thing. He said, the Jeopardy win was based on knowledge without understanding. I wouldn't even call it knowledge. And yet, if you remember the newspaper articles about strategy and decision-making, no, it was simply an algorithm. The collation and cross-referencing of facts with a certain level of confidence. But it's only a breakthrough if you assume that the human mind is really no different. Rao also stated, or Sajit Rao also said, that human language itself is imprecise. Asking Watson what time it is would be a total waste of time. It does not comprehend layers of meaning because half the time the programmers don't comprehend it themselves. J. Cyril of the University of California said about all this that Watson didn't understand the questions being asked of it, didn't understand the answers. It's just a simulation, the memorization of definitions and facts. Nothing has changed in quality, only quantity. And this goes way back. This is not a new thing. Consciousness and freedom cannot be reduced to mechanization because they're the opposite of mechanization. There was I wanted to get into an article by Richard Pluta from the Claremont Institute, The American Mind. And it had to have been a commission paper. It had to have been. Palantir's manifesto is a return to American tradition. Can you believe that? But I don't think he believes that. You know, Claremont Institute and all of these institutes require the input of billionaires all the time. In fact, he even mentions Alexander Dugin in the in this paper. He asks, why should Palantir's corporate statement cause controversy when those of Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon do not? So this was a corporate statement. Okay. What American tradition is he talking about here? It wasn't that long ago I published a paper on the founding fathers and corporations, the concept of incorporation, and went to great lengths to show and quoted many of them, showing how much they distrusted the concept. And of course, a bank and a central bank would be one of these corporations. That the privatization or the, you know, FDR took over the productive capacity of the U.S. for World War II. He sees that as part of the American tradition. But tech companies use think tanks to advocate for higher spending and expand a weapons program. Well, I mean, he's saying that like this is a good thing. Because it's happened before as part of the American tradition. He claims CARP is part of the titans who cultivated grand personas to publicize their new and disruptive technologies, like Henry Ford or Thomas Edison or Andrew Carnegie, which is a strange group of guys to mention. The Technological Republic, he argues, of course, that it's preferable that the military AI be wielded by democratic nations only. In other words, by liberal nations. Nations that, you know, Thiel really, you know, promotes gay marriage. Almost like, and going so far like Dugin did, but for the other, on the opposite side, AI is something like the arrival of gunpowder in the 16th century. He actually says that there's historical precedent for this kind of relationship. Privatization. He says, America, in essence, was founded by private companies chartered by the British Crown. The Virginia Company, the Massachusetts Bay Company. I'm not sure that that's really a really good example for what he wants to talk about. And that everything from canals and roads were done by private corporations. Hence, these oligarchs are working within the American tradition. Believe it or not, he actually makes an argument like that. And of course, he leaves out any mention of banks. For him, the intertwining of American companies, technological development, and the military, or I said among those things, that not only is a good thing, but is part of the American tradition. To be incorporated in the first half of the 19th century was very difficult. And you had to be, you had to serve the public interest. You could not give to any private candidates or give gifts to anybody in power. The minute you stepped out of that public good, that charter was withdrawn. And I don't think he realizes that. These oligarchs do not serve the general good. They reject the very concept of the general good. But this is what PR firms do, of course. They hire, I think that's what they're doing. They hire guys like him to put out some awful papers justifying all of this. So that's my take on the matter. A lot of this is PR. And if, you know, Palantir and other companies that have been used by the Pentagon, if they're any indication, if they're being used presently in this ridiculously lost war against Iran, then I don't think Dugin's predictions are going to come true. Although the regime is using everything it can to try to maintain its hold on power as its system falls apart, as the Gulf monarchies collapse, as Israel's on fire. It cannot be dismissed, however. The philosophical acumen of the founders of Palantir, though that can be dismissed. Another one of them are philosophers. But Dugin, I think, is overstating the issue. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.